From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's connection began when a group of scientists in Southern California noticed something alarming. Mountain lions, driven by shrinking habitats and encroaching urban development, were showing up in backyards and neighborhoods far outside their usual range. The cats, struggling to find food and territory, were increasingly crossing highways and busy streets, leading to a spike in fatalities. In one tragic incident, a well-known mountain lion, known as P-22, was found in a densely populated area of Los Angeles, emaciated and suffering from mange, a disease often linked to rodenticide exposure. Wildlife experts believe that climate change combined with habitat fragmentation is pushing these animals into human-dominated landscapes where they face new dangers and struggle to survive. This isn't an isolated incident either. Across the globe, animals are being displaced from their natural habitats and are arriving in unfamiliar territories where they must navigate new challenges. Whether it's mountain lions in California or elephants in India or even farm animals in rural sanctuaries, including right here in the Rochester area, the impacts of climate change are forcing species to adapt in ways that often put them at odds with the environments and the communities that they encounter. And that's what we're going to discuss today. Please help me in welcoming my panel of experts. In the studio with me, we've got Kevin Farrell, the Director of Conservation Programs from the Genesee Land Trust. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Janelle Chudik, the Director of Mockingbird Farm Animal Sanctuary. Hi, Janelle.
Hi. Thanks, Jasmine.
Did I say your last name right?
Yeah.
Great. Perfect. And Karen Berger, an Associate Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Welcome back to Environmental Connections, Karen.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So glad you're here. And joining us on the phone today is Kathy Stevens, the Founder and Executive Director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, Jasmine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. There's so much I want to cover. And let's start with you, Kevin. Kevin Farrell is the Director of Conservation Programs at Genesee Land Trust and works with private landowners, communities, and partners to conserve land and create connections to nature for everyone throughout the greater Rochester region. Kevin, when you're out in the field, what signs do you see that animals are being displaced or arriving in new areas due to climate change?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Seeing wildlife and animals join the area from different parts of the country is something I'd say we see occasionally or hear about. And on many of the properties that the Land Trust owns, we use those observations to help guide management while we're out there. So I guess common examples, we'll see non-native plants arrive in areas which very much are connected with native wildlife that are there. So we'll hear from folks if there are, new wildlife sightings or other species that, typically just aren't found there. Sometimes that's observations of things like coyotes or foxes, a lot of species that are supposed to be out in nature, but are getting more, notices of them using these spaces.
And can you share any recent experiences where these shifts were particularly evident?
Yeah, in terms of shifts, there's nothing, really evident. I think it's very much just we're seeing these other issues that the planet has in terms of habitat fragmentation. You mentioned degradation and development when combined with climate change are really forcing wildlife to use some of these spaces that we have conserved maybe more frequently.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the things that's helping drive, and really climate change is just making things worse for a lot of these species.
And I have so many more questions for you, but let's welcome our other guests. Janelle Chudik is the director of Mockingbird Farm Animal Sanctuary, a sanctuary that provides a safe haven for farmed animals who have been rescued from situations of abuse, neglect, or abandonment. Mockingbird is located in Byron, which is a small town in Genesee County. Janelle, with the extreme heat and other changing conditions, what does a typical day look like at your sanctuary as you manage the challenges of caring for animals under these growing conditions? It seems to get harsher and harsher, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, this year was the hottest on record in the 9 years that we've been here. And as our resident population grows in age, the seniors particularly are having the most difficult time. This year specifically, we have a well, so we run on a well system that's been there for, oh gosh, well over 50 or 60 years. Mm-hmm. And we can only get about 100 gallons out of that well at a time now. Wow. So we're about to hook up, thankfully, to public water, but that will increase, of course, our expenses. This year specifically, our eldest goat, Sid, he's around 18 years old, mm-hmm. and we almost lost him this summer. And even though he went through all of these diagnostics and, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of care, we couldn't really nail down what was going on. And it turns out that basically the heat had kind of just baked the gut biome and his rumen activity.
Wow.
And we had to rebuild that from the ground up. And the heat has just caused what I really want to focus on is just the chronic stress that has hit the animals this year.
And I'm seeing Kevin nodding that you're seeing that with the wild animals as well.
Yeah, I mean, just stress in general. I mean, climate change is something that causes stress to existing systems that are hurting, whether that's our local communities or wildlife. You know, thinking about these hot days that we've had this summer, those days where there's wildfire smoke from out west, that's really making these underlying health conditions worse. So that stress is just a great term when it comes to climate change that wildlife and people face.
Also with us from the world of farmed animal sanctuaries is Kathy Stevens, who's joining us today by phone. Kathy is the founder and executive director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary, which, similarly to Mockingbird, offers rescued farmed animals a chance to live their lives with dignity. And the sanctuary cares for a variety of animals, including cows, pigs, chickens, goats, sheep, horses, and more, offering them a place to live out their lives free from harm. Kathy, earlier this year, the New York Times did a huge story on how climate change was impacting Catskill Animal Sanctuary and its residents. Can you talk about the most current pressing issues the sanctuary is experiencing due to climate change?
Absolutely. One of the newer phenomenons that's associated with climate change is these bizarre systems called microbursts that just sort of dump an enormous amount of rain in a short period of time, and we're experiencing them a lot. Just an hour and a half from the sanctuary, a region of Connecticut had 12 inches of rain overnight, and a couple people died.
Wow.
At the sanctuary, we had a microburst a couple years ago that took down, in literally minutes, 22 trees, caused massive erosion. And that in turn, because we're in a valley, is creating fields that don't dry out, which causes hoof problems, and increased flooding, so that we felt like last year we had to make a decision to move out of this valley before something truly calamitous happened. If we experienced, for people in our region, if you remember either Irene or Sandy or Lee, mm-hmm. all of which occurred in the last 15 years, we couldn't survive one of those now because we've had so much tree loss and as a consequence, so much more erosion that a lot of our pastures that are on a hill are literally turning to rock.
Wow.
So that there's nothing to prevent that water from coming down and flooding our pastures and flooding our barns. And this is despite spending over two decades, several hundred thousand dollars to mitigate flooding, curtain drains, culvert pipes, you name it, pitching roads so that the water would flow away from pastures. So it's an enormous issue for us.
Kathy, I recently heard about a sanctuary in Ireland that's going through a very similar situation. And the article points out several sanctuaries in the U.S. that have already moved because of climate concerns. Do you think this will be a growing problem for sanctuaries? And is there some reason that they're more vulnerable to climate change than other kinds of facilities? Are they, and you should excuse the expression here, are they the canaries in the coal mine? And if so, why?
Well, that's a really fascinating way to phrase it. I don't think we are the canaries in the coal mine. I think we are entities that exist to ensure that animals thrive. Whereas if industry experiences flood loss, you know, loss of animals, they write it off as bad for business, but it's not going to necessarily cause them to question growing animals for food. Whereas our job is to ensure that these animals thrive. And absolutely, not only do I think it's affecting more and more of us, I know it is. I know lots of sanctuaries that are looking to move or have moved because of climate change. You know, whether it's the West Coast sanctuaries that are relocating because of fire, or Florida sanctuaries that are relocating or looking to relocate because of hurricanes, or lots of us who could be anywhere in the country, but if we're in a valley and flooding is an increasing risk, that's the issue for us, for example. You certainly want to get out of that scenario before something calamitous happens.
And just to close the loop on this, did you move your entire sanctuary?
No, we're looking. We are looking. We've looked at probably a dozen properties. We got turned down. We made a couple offers on nearby properties. Our offer wasn't accepted in one case, and then in another case, it just didn't. It was just a complicated situation with a land trust, actually. So we're still looking, but we're actively looking. It's not something we are taking at a leisurely pace.
Sure, of course. There's urgency, and I'm sure it's no small feat. You're in the Catskill area, and Janelle, you're here in the Rochester area. What do you think? Do you think that sanctuaries are going to have to up and move?
Yeah, actually, back in 2015 is when I did actually relocate from Colorado, and it was around, I think it was 2013, the Black Forest Fire had encroached onto the ranch that I was currently living at. And when I saw the flames on the horizon, I thought, okay, it's time to move. It's time to go home. And so I found this 1800s era Victorian farm and converted it into a sanctuary that was it was originally a dairy farm around 40 or 50 years ago, but it was for that reason, the exact reason that we moved back to New York. But like Kathy's saying, we are surrounded also by crop fields. We are right in the middle of fields that are all experiencing like an underground agricultural system called tiling. And so to basically take all of the water from accumulating into the fields, they all drain into the lowest part of, the land, which happened to be our sanctuary.
And you had moved here.
And we had moved here.
Right. Okay.
And then we started to kind of flood like that.
To escape. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then we had another problem on our hands. And animals hadn't been on this farm for over 40 years. So then all of a sudden we had all these very heavy animals on the farm and thought, well, what are we going to do now? So we ended up having to invest in our own tiling systems that were a little bit more manageable in our barnyards and in some of our pastures because, like Kathy was saying, mud just wreaks havoc on hooves and every other situation, parasites, pathogens, all of those things. But yeah, that brings up a whole other topic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Also I know of another sanctuary in the area, Sweet Farm Sanctuary in Himrod, which is in the Finger Lakes area, moved from Northern California as well. Because I know, relatively speaking, and we're going to speak with Dr. Karen Berger, relatively speaking, this is a climate haven, isn't it, Dr. Berger?
Yeah, by many metrics, it is. We have hot days, but our extremes are not as much as we see in other parts of the country and the world. We have plenty of water. Sometimes we have too much of it, but by and large, we have a good source of fresh water. We're not vulnerable to sea level rise. We're not vulnerable to hurricanes the same way a lot of the coastal areas are. So there's a lot of work going on looking at this region being a climate haven for people and for other animals.
So that is Dr. Karen Berger, an associate professor of earth and environmental sciences at the University of Rochester. Karen, I want you to help make sense of this for us. Fix it. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, if you can, that would be great. From a scientific perspective, how are you seeing climate change impact the health of wildlife and perhaps farmed animals as well?
Yeah, excellent question. You know, as has been talked about, you know, one of the major sources of stress is habitat fragmentation. That's dividing up and shrinking the area that a lot of wild animals and organisms can live in. And then you add to that these other climate stresses. So whether it's temperature extremes, drought, there are changes in sort of organisms that might be the food supply for these other things. And then you also have extreme events such as the microbursts or hurricane, heavy rainfall, things like that. So what's been seen globally, if we look at how animals are moving or migrating, when they have the space to do it, they are tending to go poleward, so towards northern latitudes or more southern latitudes in the southern hemisphere, and upward in elevation. So in about half of species that aren't being threatened by land use change, we're actually seeing those movements, that's the way they want to go. The big challenge is there a space to go? And when they get there, do they have the resources that they need and an absence of predators and a safe space to thrive? So we're seeing some of that happening around the world. On land, also in water, we're seeing fish moving towards, moving poleward as well.
So do you think it's strange or fascinating or anything else that we're having Kevin talking about wildlife while we're having Janelle and Kathy talking about farmed animal sanctuaries? Because to me, I see a very direct correlation here. But I'm curious if you see this as a issue that's aligned.
Absolutely. I mean, we need to be protecting the land for animals and plants to thrive. But we also have ones that can't thrive in the place where they are due to other constraints. And these sanctuaries play a really critical role in providing a safe space for them.
Thank you for validating me. And Kathy, I know that this is something you're very passionate about. Janelle, you mentioned that your sanctuary is a former dairy farm. We wanted to showcase the sanctuaries that are helping perhaps former dairy cows live out the rest of their lives because of the connection between animal agriculture and climate change. Kathy, do you want to talk about that briefly?
Sure. I mean, we're arguably the leading driver. Meat and dairy consumption are arguably the leading driver of most, if not all, of the climate challenges we're experiencing, biodiversity loss, you know, including, of course, climate change. And so we not only are a safe haven for these animals, but we are in many ways a voice for them, and we matter, because we are that safe haven, but also because we can provide those rare opportunities for the public to come and have those light bulb moments that make real for them the idea that cows, chickens, goats, pigs, sheep, etc., are every bit as individual as emotional, as desirous of living as their beloved dogs and cats are. And then the third piece is that we provide these various educational, we do some fact-based teaching, which helps people understand the impact of their daily choices when they choose to eat animals. We're not intending to harm. Nobody's trying to, you know, I love to say, nobody's waking up and saying, I can't wait to torture animals at three times a day. Nobody's saying that. But it's a sanctuary's role in part to help people understand the implications of those choices to eat meat and dairy, you know, implications for the animals, implications for their own health, and just dire implications for everything from water pollution to species extinction to climate change.
So whether people are choosing to change how they're consuming food, whether they're going vegan, or perhaps they're making more vegan choices. I'm curious, Karen, is there data available that can help us get a picture of which animals are being forced into new areas or how they're struggling to adapt to altered environments? Because what we consume is directly related to why these animals are struggling in the first place.
Yeah, so when you look at which animals are being affected, it depends a lot on where you are and which ones you're focusing on. Unfortunately, a lot of the pests and insects are thriving as they get forced into new environments. They really like these different conditions. And it is very much a question of when they get to that new space, do they have the resources that they need? And are they also causing a problem when you have, say, mountain lions or other things ending up in someone's backyard? Perhaps you have issues adjacent to some of the national parks with wolves coming in. And so there's a real question. It's very, I would say, very site-specific, okay, depending on what the impacts are.
Kevin, let's turn back to you. The challenges that you face in the field are, of course, part of a much larger global issue that we're touching on. And I'm finding the cyclical nature of this conversation really interesting. Just, you know, how when farmed animals are commodified, it helps to create climate change. And then that in turn impacts the lives of both farmed animals and wild animals. You recently got from Cornell University I was going to say you recently got $35 million. That would be lovely.
That would be nice.
Cornell University recently received a $35 million gift to establish the K. Lisa Yang Center for Wildlife Health, which aims to address these very challenges at this intersection that we're talking about today: wildlife, domestic animal health, farmed animals, environmental sustainability. What kind of research is being done? How do you see it impacting your own work on the ground as you deal with displaced species?
Yeah, so the first part of the question there was just looking at the cyclical nature, you know, and looking at something like farm animals and wildlife. And the study of ecology is the relationships between animals and their physical environment. And that's really understanding how things are connected, where nothing exists in a vacuum. You know, affecting one thing will affect another. And very much in the natural world and, you know, on farms, you know, that's how it works. So when you get things, you know, pests coming in, like the ones you hear about from spotted lanternfly to hemlock woolly adelgid, they affect the whole system. So they will impact hemlock trees and they'll be lost along stream banks that keep the water cool and clean for trout that we're seeing diminished populations in. But with regards to the Cornell K. Lisa Yang Center, I looked into it a little bit, and you know, it's not something I'm super familiar with, but based on their website, they definitely focus on education, discovery, but also engagement and policy. So I really think the key word there is engagement. So I'll be curious to follow them and see how they can engage people and to show people the connections between wildlife, farm animals, and the impacts from climate change and all the other issues.
Kevin, can you share a story of some animals who belong to a particular species who have arrived in your area because they were unable to adapt?
So arrived in our area, unable to adapt. So species coming from the south, and I'm going to go back to sort of the insects and the pests that are there. In the 1950s, hemlock woolly adelgid really started destroying trees down in the Smokies. And those trees have, you know, you go down there now and it's like, you know, not many trees left that you see, so many dead standing trees. And that insect has made its way up this way. And over the past, I don't know, decade or so, has really been harming eastern hemlocks in our area down in the Finger Lakes, arrived in the Adirondacks maybe 5 years ago. And that has just, you know, been very detrimental because there are many native species, certain birds like black-throated green warbler, black-burnian warbler, birds that really depend on those forests with eastern hemlocks. So when we lose that tree, we've got those cascading effects of losing habitat for native plants and animals, but also losing those ecosystem services that those trees provide while holding soil on steep banks so it can keep water, again, cool and clean for brown trout and brook trout locally.
And that's Kevin Farrell, Director of Conservation Programs from the Genesee Land Trust. If you're listening to this, you're listening to Environmental Connections, and we do want to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're local, 585-263-9994. That's 585-263-9994. You can also email connections at WXXI.org, but hopefully you'll do it soon so that we can get to your questions. We're discussing today with our panel of experts how animals are being displaced due to climate change and how sanctuaries are being displaced due to climate change. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, I have some questions for you, Janelle, about ash trees. We'll be right back.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we have some national programming coming your way. In our first hour, the state of education 70 years after Brown v. Board of Education. And in our second hour, a program called Long Shadow, In Guns We Trust. That's coming your way on Monday. Happy Labor Day.
I'm Jasmine Singer, and you're listening to Environmental Connections. We're having a really fascinating chat today with our panel of experts. We're discussing how climate change is displacing animals, wild animals, and farmed animal sanctuaries. As we talked about before, it is a cyclical issue, and it's something that I think this panel is showing that we're all dealing with on different levels. One of our guests today is Janelle Chudik from Mockingbird Farm Animal Sanctuary. Janelle, you've had to make significant adaptations due to the loss of your ash trees. How is that related to climate change, and what has it been like to implement these changes, and how have the animals responded?
So it's been devastating. I mean, just it's straight up devastating. We have, when we moved to this farm, it was green and lush and beautiful 10 years ago. And we had a whole patch of mostly ash trees and two gigantic shade trees in our pastures that were ash. And as the emerald ash borer beetle, I guess, and maybe Kevin can speak more about this, but made its way up in our area, it just completely decimated these trees. And we had probably seven trees that were all, I mean, gigantic trees that were all killed. And they become a hazard. They will fall on fences. They're very dangerous. And then it also took away all of the shade in the pastures for our animals. And so they have to come into the barn and be, you know, with fans or whatever it might be that we do to mitigate the heat. But that's been awful. We've had to put up shade structures that we've never had to do before. It's really tough. Wow. And I, you know, kind of in conjunction with that, this year reaching around 100 degrees in the spring, the animals hadn't yet even had a chance to shed their winter coats. So it was just brutal. We had animals that were fighting health crisis and heat stress that we've never had before.
Ugh, that's hard. You're dealing with a lot. And Kathy, yeah. I know you're dealing with a lot too. And I hear you nodding and agreeing. What's it been like for you? Have you experienced similar issues that have required adaptations?
100%. We've lost half of our trees. A lot of ash. Like Janelle, a lot of hickory, and then random, both hardwoods and evergreens, just because of the flooding
and the wind. You know,
the wind. So we've had pastures we haven't used in a couple years because there's literally no shade. And then you know, we've adapted just like Janelle has, but at the top of our list for the move is large patches of forest, so that hopefully there's no guarantee that something else won't come along. We were horrified to see our first spotted lanternfly the other day, just terrified about the implications of that. We're, you know, so we've got it. Our priorities for our move is that a large percentage of our new property will be shaded, And with trees that at least we hope are going to be resistant to some of these invasive bugs that we're seeing. And also that we're, you know, right now we're in a bowl. We want to be at the opposite. We want lots of high ground on which to build so that we can mitigate against any flooding.
I mean, you're also dealing with, both you and Janelle are dealing with animals who are older than many other farmed animals will ever see. So you're also dealing with the veterinary challenges that I think many veterinarians probably have never even seen, because many of these animals have been bred to be slaughtered at very, very young ages. And you're mentioning you have an 18-year-old goat. So, Dr. Berger, switching to you here, I'm curious, in your research, what are the most significant challenges for animals who are arriving in new areas because of climate? Are there any particular examples where the displacement has led to unexpected impacts?
Yes, what we're seeing are that some of them are not finding the resources that they need in terms of space, that they may have unexpected predators or diseases. One of the things that we're seeing, maybe not unexpected but unfortunate, is that a lot of disease-causing organisms are successfully moving into new areas and causing these harms to forests and other animals. One of the numbers that I was sad to see is that they estimate that 40% of major pest species are going to get more effective and more harmful in a warming climate, whereas only a few percent of them are going to become less harmful.
Wow.
And then I think what we see with the larger wild animals are that what you alluded to at the beginning with the mountain lions is that sometimes you have them not finding enough food, being hit by cars, really not being able to thrive in that new environment, which is a combination of the climate stresses as well as being in a human fragmented environment where they're not intended to be.
I have another question for you, and Kevin, be aware, I'm going to ask this of you too. Karen, how do you see, or how do these shifts, whether it's animals arriving in new areas or struggling to adapt because they can't reach their natural habitats, affect the broader ecosystem? What are the ripple effects that you've observed?
So we're seeing a lot of impacts on forests and trees in general, as has been alluded to. And then we're also seeing in certain places that when some of these organisms come in and do well, that they threaten the food supply for the existing species that are there. We see this particularly in marine environments where you have fish moving poleward into places and then depleting the lower parts of the food supply.
Kevin, what about you? What have you seen?
You know, all very similar things there. It's, you know, at the local level, it's just, you know, thinking about those roles that different species play. And when there's more competition, that leads to less success amongst populations of different animals. So definitely seeing that competition and just lower resources for everyone. So, again, it's largely an issue of, you know, added stress all around. And as Dr. Berger mentions, some of these species, pest species in particular, and plants are known as sleeper species. They're here. They're non-native. They're not quite invasive yet. But as the climate continues to warm, they might become invasive. So that's one of the scariest things to think about when it comes to wildlife and climate change.
If you want to join in on the conversation, 844-295-8255. That's 844-295-TALK. Or if you're local, 585-263-9994. Connections at WXXI.org is another way you can reach us. I do want to talk about interventions. Like, I want to bring us back up. But before we do, let's go a little further down. let's talk about health issues. Kathy, on your end, what have you seen health-wise with your residents due to what's going on right now with the climate? And how do you expect these issues to increase?
We've seen asthma. We've seen animals pretty darn close to heat stroke. I think the health impacts are a lesser concern, but only because sanctuaries have gotten quite good at adapting, as Janelle referenced. You know, we even have an air conditioned barn for the old oldies,
aww,
seniors, you know, the 26-year-old cow, et cetera.
Wow. That's amazing.
We don't have one that old now, but we do have just a lot of ancient animals. So I'm not seeing so much the impact yet on their health, with the exception of a freak thing called liver flukes that live, that are carried in snails, and snails, of course, are attracted to wet ground. And liver flukes can cause death in animals. And we did lose a goat because of liver flukes. And, you know, again, the vets are sort of catching up and trying to keep pace with the pace of change. And, you know, again, I think the health concerns are secondary. We're just worried about things like heat exhaustion.
Right.
Because of the, heat exhaustion, and then the constant management of hooves in animals that we have no higher dry ground to utilize.
Sanctuaries are just new terrain in every possible way. Like, we're just learning as we go sometimes.
But can I, Jasmine, before you pivot, can I just say what I appreciate about what you bring, how you've
Please. You can always say what you appreciate about me, Kathy.
to position animal agriculture, which you're sort of doing, as the foundational problem is imperative. If we don't position it as the foundational problem, we are really just dancing around the edges. And if the policymakers aren't going to center it, which they aren't, then it's up to the rest of us to continue to try to push, because unless we center it as the foundational problem, we're not going to arrive at real and lasting and systemic change.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you bringing that up. Janelle, I see you also nodding.
I would love to kind of piggyback that on just really quick, because as far as health implications go, what we're seeing is a true combination of this, of the increased temperatures, the duration, the intensity of these heat waves that creates just this unsustainable amount of chronic stress for the animals. And I'm sure that that goes for wildlife as well. We've had to change everything from diets and add supplements and do all the things. But I read this study recently that was actually an agricultural-based study that was talking about, with climate change, we see the impacts of chronic stress, metabolic and hormone disruptions, decreased immunity, and all of these issues are being currently studied in various ways, and we're seeing them happen in real time right here on sanctuaries. But you know, they're seeing them for production, like reproduction and those types of things, whereas we're just trying to care for them and their for the rest of their days. But like us, we don't really have that thermal stress resistance. We suffer, they suffer, and the problem really is, in my opinion, the chronic stress of the heat and humidity just lasting for weeks and weeks has lasting, often fatal repercussions when there is just no respite or break in the heat.
That's a lot. It's a lot. And Dr. Berger, can you please fix it?
Well, not with one swipe, but you know, there's a lot of things that can be done, and I'm going to focus a little bit more on wild animals, but some of the sanctuary issues will come up as well. You know, one is what we call connectivity conservation. So really trying to connect physical spaces that are preserved habitat, so that as animals need to migrate, when their climate modifies, they have a space to go. And that could be connected preserves. It could be there are also highway overpasses and different kinds of strategies like that. Another thing that people are looking at is called assisted migration, or sometimes managed translocation. So the idea that you actually are taking plant species or animal species and moving them to a more suitable habitat given the climate changes. And, you know, the big caveat there is you have to be really careful that you don't introduce more problems by moving them, you know, bringing in a predator where there wasn't one before. But people look at saving polar bears that way, for example. Other things that are relevant sort of, and I guess that would also tie into moving the sanctuaries to where they can prosper. But looking at restoring and creating the habitat, like the kind of work that the Land Trust does, cooling rivers so that you have cool, clear temperatures, and also in the process, really trying to take advantage of the local and traditional knowledge, because I think a lot of the traditional indigenous knowledge in this country has been adapting to changing climate in different ways, and we can learn a lot from them and their processes.
Very, very important to remember that. I'm so happy you brought that up. Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to do your work? Because I've been there. I've been to your incredibly beautiful grounds. It was featured on the TV show version of Environmental Connections, which people who are listening to this now could go to pbs.org and just type in Environmental Connections and you could see it for yourself. But tell us a little bit about being on the ground there, what you're seeing.
Yeah, so as Dr. Berger mentioned, this connectivity conservation, it's very much, if you think of a puzzle, conservation is finding those puzzle pieces and putting them back together. Our property and our lands throughout the region have been subdivided so much over the years, we're just having smaller and smaller pieces of land that really don't benefit every species. So, you know, as an example, great horned owls need, I think, around 150 acres to successfully forage, breed, et cetera. And that's a big chunk of land. So every species have different habitat requirements. So, but with Genesee Land Trust, a lot of the work is, you know, starting those conversations or finding landowners who are willing to think about conservation as an option for their property. Some have, you know, connections to the land, whether they were born there or they had special moments with their family there or really high quality natural resource values like wetlands that they want to conserve. And these conversations can take over 10 years, but Genesee Land Trust is in it for the long haul. We're trying to make spaces that can help people with their lives in terms of recreation, staying cool, having enough shade, but also benefiting wildlife with, again, places to go as the climate warms. So, and I think the Land Trust and everyone else at this table really understands that how many layers there are here in terms of priorities, challenges, and opportunities. So it's multifaceted and can be very difficult at times, but there are successes and things that we hear that show that there are good things happening as well.
Tell us about a good thing that's happening.
So in the wildlife perspective, two species in particular, the fisher, which is a small carnivore, which folks might not be too familiar with. Recommend to Google it. It's a species that has made a comeback in the past several decades. And several years ago, I was out walking one of our protected properties in Wayne County and saw three fishers there. And they're really an indicator of sort of habitat quality and habitat health. So when we can see things like the fishers returning to certain properties, a very charismatic bird called the bobolink, the R2D2 bird, is one that we manage for as well. So when we have high quality grasslands and we get those species returning, that indicates that we're doing something correct. And then being able to get people out there to make those connections so they can care in the future is another priority. So seeing those connections, seeing that joy come to people when they're outdoors is a big priority. And, you know, smiles go a long way.
It is otherworldly. It is absolutely stunning. And right after we interviewed you, we got caught in this giant downpour, like with the camera equipment and everything. And it was like, just exhilarating. Since the camera equipment was fine, I can say now, it was exhilarating. So people can visit, right?
Yes. So that property is Cornwall Preserve. That's out in Pulteneyville in the town of Williamson. It's two-thirds a mile right on Lake Ontario. There's a parking lot and trails, some interpretive signs. And again, is the type of space that we want to work with communities to create and really give folks the opportunity to connect with the outdoors, escape all these other stressors in their lives and places for wildlife as well. So check out that website, GenesseeLandTrust.org, where we've got a whole list of the properties you can visit.
And while we're talking about visiting programs, Janelle, can people visit Mockingbird Farm Animal Sanctuary?
Yes, absolutely. This has been a really tough summer for us with just the heat, the staffing, the volunteers. We don't have a full-time staff by any means. We're, you know, I'm a volunteer. I'm the founder and I'm a volunteer. So we haven't been able to give as many tours as we usually do, but we have an upcoming, our biggest fundraiser of the year is October 12th from noon to 5 p.m. And you can come. It's just a suggested donation of $10 at the door, whatever you can pay. Lots of fun, family-free like activities, and you can experience the animals on their own terms. But folks can absolutely write us and ask to come visit. We're an extremely transparent sanctuary. We want everybody who's interested in learning more to come visit the sanctuary.
And where is it located?
We're in Byron, New York. It's about 35 minutes west of Rochester. That's actually exactly 35 minutes from right here where we're sitting.
Okay.
And but just like Kathy, we're really focused on education. And I really think that that's the biggest piece is get to know, have conversations, have hard conversations. There's a lot of focus. I don't want to derail the conversation very much, but there's a huge, huge uproar in the BLM rounding up of Mustangs out west right now. And making the connection of how heartbreaking that is, but that's because they're creating land for beef cattle to graze. That's the problem. So I think getting to know where these problems and the sources of these issues are coming from, that's really where this stuff needs to start.
I'm glad that you brought that up. And I have also had the honor of being at Mockingbird Sanctuary. And same thing, I just really strongly encourage our listeners to visit and to bring your children and young people in your life. And for your weekend getaway, your next weekend getaway down to the Catskills, Kathy, you also have a visiting program.
We do. We're open on Saturdays and Sundays. We have day passes for people who don't want to do a formal tour, but the tours are great. They are offered by people who have been here for years and know the animals like people know their own animals. And there's a variety of tours. There's a kids tour, there are day passes, and there are more organized tours starting at 10 on Saturdays and Sundays.
I wanted to make sure to get that in, and I'm glad that I did, because these are all just, it's very important to just make sure that we're out in these communities and that we're seeing firsthand the animals who are being most impacted by climate change. And as our guests are talking about today, it's the wild animals, it's the farmed animals, it's also the human animals.
I was just going to say that. The caretakers, too.
The caretakers, sure. How are the caretakers in at both Genesee Land Trust as well as Mockingbird Sanctuary having to deal with the climate issues going on? I'm sure it's impacting everyone.
Yeah. I'm sure we have the same thoughts looking over at each other, but it's hot out there. So when you're outdoors, mowing trails, taking care of trees that fall across the trail or dead ash trees, it takes a lot of work to do that. It's so hot out there. The extreme weather events is, makes it very difficult, but finding those shaded areas but it's tough managing outdoor spaces.
It is, and it's really tough, too, because we want to keep our volunteers safe and give them spaces to cool down and breaks and anything that they might need while they're out here, because stacking 300 bales of hay in 100-degree weather is not good for anybody, especially when you're about to go do 6 more hours of hard manual labor. We make it a point to I know it sounds wild, but we pick up almost every bit of manure that we can twice a day, because we just want to decrease the parasite load and control, and that's how we do that. And so it just takes, and we do everything by hand. We unfortunately have a tractor or anything like that on our property. So everything is done by hand, and it's a lot of work. I probably take 3 showers a day just to cool off, and I'm sweating in the shower.
You don't smell, I will say, for our listeners, since it's not smell-o-vision. We have an email from Colleen. Colleen says, I'm in the car, I happened upon this program. So good, even though so concerning. Thank you, Jasmine. Thank you, Colleen. It is concerning. Karen, how concerned are you when you're here and you're listening to this panel of experts talking, and given the work that you do, because you're really, this is what you've devoted your life to. How are you feeling? Let's do a check-in with you.
Well, it feels like every conversation about climate change, there's a combination of terror, but also I try to walk out of that with a combination of how can I have some hope and think about things that are ways to move forward. That's important in the classroom. It's important in our daily lives. It's important in the work we do out in the field. And so I try to find small victories, right? So I'm going to share with you a small victory, which was that this past summer, the Fish and Wildlife Service changed its plan for dealing with endangered species. And they said, if you're trying to protect a species, you no longer have to put it where it has always been. Now you can. They have acknowledged that its proper habitat may have moved with a changing climate. And so that may sound like a small shift, but it's an acknowledgement of our changing situation. You know, whether it's the trees that we're having to plant, whether it's the animals we're having to protect, the new water sources we're needing to find, looking for those things and trying to maximize at the same time as we're trying to do what Kathy mentioned, also think about the systemic change and the roots of these problems.
That's beautifully said. It's a great way to end on. Kathy, what gives you hope, real quick?
The transformational moments that people have with animals.
Mm-hmm.
These animals change people. When a turkey sits in your lap, when a cow licks your face, then you are fundamentally and often forever changed. Our animals are our best vegan makers. They give me hope, and the numbers of people who've written in or phoned in or hugged us with tears in their eyes, they give me hope. And I'm mildly hopeful about the upcoming election cycle and the way to center climate change if we have the outcome that we want. That might be a bit naive, but a girl can dream.
Sure, why not? Kevin, really, really quickly, what gives you hope?
Seeing smiles, seeing laughter outdoors, whether that's, you know, birding, you know, seeing cool wildlife outside or having a barbecue or playing basketball and smiling with friends and family.
Love that, Janelle.
Honestly, it's compassion and community. Everything. I think when I've got a big work team together at the farm and everybody is sweating but working so hard, all in this with the same goal in mind, that's what keeps me going. That's what gives me hope. There's lots of us out there.
There's lots of us out there. Thank you so much to my guests, Kevin Farrell from the Genesee Land Trust, Janelle from Mockingbird Farm Animal Sanctuary, Karen Berger, who teaches Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, and Kathy Stevens, the founder and executive of Catskill Animal Sanctuary. I'm Jasmine Singer. If you're listening to this, a big thanks to you for making today's Environmental Connections.